This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Karen Reid, that's who we're going to be talking about right now. And of course, Karen, we've had many conversations, getting closer and closer to a potential new trial date, which is not really all that super far off. We're going to be cutting right to the chase of this roller coaster of a case here. The legal twists, the disputed evidence, the unexpected turns, the mistrial to new legal motions and mounting allegations of investigative misconduct. And the retrial date set for April 2025. Fresh developments emerging almost every single week. The future's wide open for surprises. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, joining us to have the conversation. Eric, given your background on both sides of the courtroom, what's your take on these recent motions that have been raised in the case about the evidence, the cell phone dates, the how's long to die in cold, and everything else that they're throwing at the wall as it's going forward?
Yeah, so much going on. One thing that jumps out at me is defense's motion to try to eliminate two of the three charges. What they're arguing is that the jury essentially came together and acquitted on the second degree murder charge, a very serious charge, and also leaving the scene of a death in an automobile. And so I think those charges have significant merit, and there's a chance the judge either brings back in the jury to talk about them or whatever. But if those charges are dismissed, it could certainly change the complexion of the new trial set for April.
What sort of precedent exists for that sort of thing happening? I mean, as a layperson out here, it's like you can't go back and change your verdict. And I know the argument here is, well, they didn't fully understand that they could have done this. It wasn't this or that. It wasn't communicated. I don't know. But at the end of the day, I don't know. Has there been other cases where they come back and bring the jury back in going, oh, did you not quite ever understand everything? I know you've been out there and you've seen everything that was not allowed into the trial. And now you have a different opinion. I mean, how do you justify something like that?
It would be unusual for sure. Usually how it plays out is the jury acquits on a greater charge at a trial, but is hung on a lesser charge. And then there's a retrial on the lesser charge. Here, there was no such final acquittal on any of the charges. Now defense is going to say, hey, the jury was kind of confused and they actually did reach a conclusion on two of them, but we just didn't, finalize that. Could a judge say that Karen Reid had her trial and a jury of her peers acquitted her on two charges, or at least that's what defense is saying. Let's look into it. I think a judge could.
Has this been done in the past? Is there precedent for this?
I've never seen a particular case where there was no final acquittal at trial, and then the defense says, hey, actually, the jurors did reach an acquittal. It just wasn't, set in stone, so we got to revisit that. I've never seen that happen, but I think that there are grounds to at least argue it and for a judge to consider it.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting. I mean, I'm thinking of other cases here. What I've been saying on the Delphi case that we've been talking a lot about is I feel bad for those jurors. I mean, I'm guessing they walked out of there and once they saw all the other evidence, if they paid attention to it more, might have been like, oh, shit. And granted, this is a very different argument. It's not like, oh, we came out and we saw more and we're changing our opinion. They're like, no, our opinion was this, but we just didn't know how to express it at the time. I get where it's coming from. I totally do. And I think it was very murky waters and gray areas where things weren't communicated the best that they could have been to allow them to do that. But again, you didn't have anybody asking for polling of the jury or anything. I mean, and what sort of rights did the defense of Karen Reid had and the prosecution of Karen Reid had at the time when the verdict came in? Could they have raised some of these issues right away just to kind of cross that T and dot that I when they had the opportunity?
If a mistrial is communicated to the judge by the jurors, could defense poll that jury? I don't think they have a right to. I don't think the prosecution has a right to. I think the judge probably has some discretion in inquiring of the jury. So, you know, one side could say, hey, why don't you ask the jury, you know, where they landed and if they did actually reach a final conclusion. That never happened. And so that could be a misstep for defense. And an appellate judge could see that as precluding the defense from sort of reopening something that was closed shut once that trial was finished.
Do you see any way with these arguments being made that an appellate judge looks at this, or if it gets back to some place where we just simply don't have another Karen Reed trial, we look at this and go, there was a lot of errors here, there was a lot of errors there, and it's just up in the air and we just want this thing to end?
You know, certainly Karen Reed would be hoping for that, but I think that she would be hoping in vain, because I don't see that happening whatsoever. I think the prosecution is gung-ho on this. It's a very public trial, right? And so, and arguably the prosecution sustained some embarrassment from not being able to secure a conviction during this, you know, weeks-long trial where they paraded all of these witnesses and evidence. And so I think they're kind of chomping at the bit to get back at this. And they would be the only ones who would be empowered to truly dismiss the case under these circumstances.
Are they going to get through to another jury? I mean, I guess, I think it was argued as best as it could be. I thought there were some things that could have been done better. But, I mean, we're talking about a lot of the same information here, a lot of the same evidence, and throwing it to another group of folks that's already quite divided in this community. I mean, the odds of getting another mistrial are pretty high. I mean, does this just go on indefinitely? If there is another mistrial, at what point does someone say nobody's going to know the true answer to this, no matter who you ask, no matter who you interview, no matter what expert you put on the stand?
You know, I'm not aware of any rule that or law or legal authority that says, you know, after five mistrials, the case has to be dismissed or something like that. I think the prosecution can continue to persist in their prosecution. You know, can they really improve their case? Maybe bits and pieces here, but the core of the case is what it is. The advantage they have, however, is they know what hand the defense is likely to play, and so they can better prepare to rebut some of the doubt that the defense apparently injected in the first trial.
You think the defense is going to play the same card again? There was the house party. He got killed in the party. They drug him to the curb and left him for dead.
You know, I think that's reasonably likely, with a few bells and whistles put on there. You know, now they have this expert who is apparently a dog bite expert and is going to allege that something happened with a dog that caused injury to the victim. So, you know, I think that they're probably going to beef up their defense, but I think the core of it's going to remain the same. We're not going to see some, you know, crazy, you know, it wasn't Karen Reed driving, it was somebody else. I don't think we'll see something like that.
The dog's still alive. The dog can be tested. The dog already had a mouth mold done to show where the canines and all those are, to match that sort of stuff up. I mean, how accurate is matching that sort of stuff up, and why has it not been used? Because this dog seems to be a pretty big part of this case, and nobody on either side has seemed to take advantage of the resources that are available to argue their side.
I hear you. And I can't help but wonder if that's because both sides are afraid of what further inquiry into the dog bite thing could mean. You know, defense could look into it. They think they're on reasonably solid footing. They have this expert who will say, hey, we think this dog bit the decedent. But if they look into it more, and perhaps, you know, the alignment of the teeth does not square with the injuries on the body, the defense is in a horrible position then. They have to maybe scrap that entire expert or look like fools. So perhaps they're just a little bit worried about what getting closer to the truth could mean.
Well, it seems like such an absolute argument that they're trying to make, that this was Chloe, the dog that you know, bit him in the house or came out and bit him or something. Okay, I have three dogs here. They're my executive producers. There's one right here, there's one over there, and there's one over there. And they all have very different sizes and shapes of mouths. I would think that you could get kind of an idea, or at least something of like, okay, this is pretty close to like what it would look like if it was this type of dog that bit this person, or that very dog, or the one over here that's a completely different size and shape of mouth. But again, that never has been done. And the absolute of this, of it, it must be Chloe, I think is kind of BS. I mean, we're talking a snowstorm is coming in. There's a forest behind the house. There's known coyote problems in the neighborhood. And so there's the coyote theory, which I've been saying for a long time, and so is my friend Bob Mata. But take that even out of the equation. Maybe it's just a stray dog. Maybe it's somebody else's dog. There's a storm coming in. Let the dog out really quick late at night. If John O'Keefe is at the front of the yard, and the dogs are out there for a few minutes. I know I have neighbors that just kind of let them out into the streets, and then sometimes they wander. Yeah, a dog might start biting on something that they think is dead. There just seems to be a lot of possibilities here of how, if it is a dog, it could have happened. But we're still like trying to figure out even if it is actually a dog, considering there's no DNA from a dog found on John O'Keefe.
I think you touch on a serious issue for the defense here, because they're saying it was Chloe the dog. Okay, who did what? What did the dog do? There's no bite marks, you know, to the decedent's jugular or something that would have caused a lethal blow to this human being. You know, maybe there was some interaction with the dog and some injuries were sustained, but so what? That likely didn't kill this person. And I think it could be kind of just a nothing burger.
That's what I feel about this. I mean, to me, it looks like road rash. It reminds me, you know, when you fall off your bike as a kid and, you know, yeah, I mean, you could look at them and go, look, I got bit by a vampire. And it's just, you know, the way the stones lined up on the concrete and the way you scraped your arm. And it looks like that, or a dog or whatever. But again, no dog DNA. I would think if the dog incisors went into you, you'd have something there. I mean, they did find the pig DNA, which I found to be a little interesting. But if a dog is eating pig-based snacks or something, I get how that could occur. I just don't know how you can go to the absolute again that this is Chloe the dog that actually did this. And again, as to what extent, it's not part of like the piece that brought him down. This looks far more like a stray dog or Chloe or a coyote or whatever wandered through the neighborhood, found a body and was kind of picking at it a little bit like animals do.
Totally. I mean, what was defense going to argue that Chloe the dog bit the decedent and then they took the decedent out in the cold and he died in the cold? Like, it's just a kind of a bizarre sequence of events that doesn't really square with common sense. And so it could just really be kind of a red herring that defense is trying to inject into this trial to elicit more confusion.
Well, completely. And look, I know people go into the argument, well, it's a real corrupt police force, there's all these issues. Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think there's a ton of issues there, especially when you go to the Sandra Birchmore end of things. But the crazy part about all of that is just, I mean, the fact that you're in now involving like the families of these officers. And I don't know if the officers at the house were corrupt or not, but it sure seems that they're pretty close to a lot of folks who are. But then you're interjecting, well, and the wife is, and the daughter is, and this person is, and like all these people who, you know, if somebody's shady on their job, it doesn't mean their whole family's, you know, in on the gig. That's the other part of this, too. And then, of course, causing all of the trauma for these folks, being ridiculed, being stalked, being, you know, everything that's gone on to that family after those allegations have been made.
Yeah, and defense on that point has to be careful about overplaying their hand. Look, this is a death case, and it's pretty undisputed that the decedent did nothing wrong and lost his life. And so if you have some evidence of a conspiracy or police misconduct, you should present that. But if you stretch it too much, a jury is likely to see that and start to call BS. And if they start to call BS on one aspect of the defense, they can call it on the entire defense, and that's a problem.
Yeah, and that's another big piece here I want to talk about calling BS on the defense. There seems to be a piece in this case that when I look at it, again, I'm not, I think Karen Reed should probably be free. Not that I think she wasn't involved in his death. I think it was a horrible accident. I think everybody's been drugged through the coals. And at this point, we're never really going to know. And I think everybody has regret. Nobody, I think, set out to murder anyone that night. The other part of this case that is really troubling to me is the cell phone data. To me, if you were to go to an expert, not even just an expert, let's go to the company that decodes this information that you're relying on for your data, and they explain to you what you're looking at. You'd already looked at it and said, well, here's what this is. Well, the company says, no, it's not. You're actually inaccurate, but here's what it really is. We understand how you may have taken it that way, but at a deeper dive, things you don't see on the surface, here's what the timeline really is for when these searches were conducted. The fact that you have the actual company giving you the ingredients to the secret sauce and somebody else is saying, I don't think those are the right ingredients. It's just kind of denying reality at this point, saying, well, we got a guy over here who thinks they make a better recipe. Great, but it's not the recipe that answers your question.
Yeah, it's kind of like exactly what you said. The company saying this is the recipe and defense is saying, nuh-uh. But defense found a little wrinkle within that data. You know, the way that data is presented is very confusing. And there's like, I forget the language they use, but it's like GTC plus 3 hours or something. And so it lends itself to some confusion and some perhaps misinterpretation. And defense is using that to their full advantage. They may be totally wrong, but if they create in the jurors' minds some confusion about that, sometimes confusion equals doubt equals reasonable doubt.
I get it. If you're the defense attorney, you're going to want to try and bring that in. But should the judge even allow it in, just considering it's not accurate? I mean, it's just not a fact. The company, here's the recipe. Somebody over here, no, it's actually, it's not. It's just not. There's fact and there's fiction. And there's misinterpreting things. And then if you are corrected, sometimes you just got to own up and go, yeah, okay, that was wrong. I mean, it, number one, I think it could be a huge danger for the defense to even bring it in, because I would see them getting hammered every which way going, I think that needed to be a much stronger point that was argued in the original trial, which I don't think the prosecution really did a good job at. But I think this time you really got to hammer that forward. But again, judges shouldn't be letting things into the case that really don't have a whole lot of merit to them, especially when it is just factual data. It's not a storyline. It's not an eyewitness testimony. It's just factual data. How often does things like this get into courts and into the actual trial when, you know, on the outside, it is, here's the data. This is what it is.
Yeah, so judges are the gatekeepers of evidence that goes to the jury. And part of their role is to ensure that only competent evidence goes. It can't be speculation. It can't be something fabricated. It's got to have a basis in fact. That being said, some judges are reluctant to preclude experts because they're worried about getting reversed on appeal. And so I can't help but wonder if the judge perhaps sort of compromised in her own head on this expert and said, it's a little questionable, but I don't want my butt to be on the line on appeal, so I'm going to let it in and see what the jury does.
But because then you can go to, you're right, I hear you, where you don't want my butt to be on the line if it goes to appeals because another judge could see it differently. But how is everybody on a different page when it comes to facts? You know, that's the thing. How can everyone be on a different page when it's simply factual data? It's like, if I type the letter A into the computer and it's on Word, it's the letter A. You can't reinterpret that some other way. It is what it is.
And that should be the prosecution's closing argument on that issue. You know, that's one thing the prosecution has to do. As a former prosecutor, you've got to kind of dispel the smoke and mirrors that the defense might be trying to put up and bring the jury back to reality and say, hey, no, these are the facts and this is how it is.
Yeah, it just seems like facts are very optional sometimes in these cases. And then it's left to a jury to try and figure that out. I mean, I'm sure I've seen this. I mean, it's sometimes a battle of who can confuse the jury the most and put that reasonable doubt in there. It's just, it's so, angering when you see it being done with things that are truly factual, that there's not a lot of debate on, that you can't really debate. But then that ends up swaying it, or ends up with a mistrial like we saw last time.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's some defense attorney's strategy to inject as much confusion and disarray and everything else into the trial, because they believe that confusion could lead to doubt. The jury could say, gosh, well, I'm confused. I don't know what the data actually says now. And is that doubt, is that confusion, does it translate to doubt? Does it translate to reasonable doubt? A lot of defense attorneys take that route.
Is that what is going on here? I mean, it's just that's the only strategy you really have. Let's throw everything out there because all the facts really don't look very good for Karen Reed.
The defense has really mucked things up, probably intentionally. You have the cell phone data issue, you have the dog bite, potential red herring, and then you have the police misconduct, which is problematic, but might not prove innocence. And they're kind of just thinking, hey, let's have a constellation of all these things, put them together, and hopefully the jury comes out in our favor.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.